to the floor. For a moment, Peter was speechless. Then questions came flooding out. Can you do that any time? He began. I mean, could you just fly around whenever you want, like a bird? No, said Molly. To fly, I must use the power of the star stuff, and we, the star catchers, carry only a limited amount. In time, it wears off. We're supposed to use it only in an emergency. I really shouldn't have used it just now. It's precious, and I really don't know how much I have in here. She tapped her locket and tucked it back into her blouse. But can't you just get more? Said Peter. From the trunk, I mean. There must be lots in there. Yes, there is, said Molly. There's enough in that trunk that I could fly forever and do many other things besides. Is that why you're so concerned about it? Said Peter. Because you want to get it? No, Peter, I told you before. Our task is to get the star stuff before the others do and return it.
But why don't you just keep it? Said Peter.
Because of the power, said Molly. The power is too great. There's too much danger that it can be used for evil.
But the star catchers, you're good, aren't you? Said Peter. If you have the power, why don't you just use it to control these others?
Because it doesn't work, said Molly. Because if people have the power, even if they start out using it for good, in time they will use it for evil.
How do you know that?
Because that's how it all started, this business of the star catchers and the others. It's been going on for thousands of years, Peter. Nobody knows precisely when it started, but in the beginning, somebody must have stumbled across some star stuff that had fallen to Earth. And whoever that was touched it and felt it. It's a wonderful feeling, Peter. Not just the flying. That's the most obvious, but there's much more.
Like what?
Intelligence, for one thing. It's not so much that you become smarter as that you feel as though you can really use your mind. You can see things you couldn't see before, understand things that others can't. Sometimes you even know what other people are feeling. You can feel it. And sometimes, if you're close enough, you can change the way they feel. Make them afraid or happy or sleepy.
The guard, said Peter. The night I saw you in the room with the trunk and the rat...
The guard fell asleep that night. Slank thought he was drunk. But you made that happen.
Yes, said Molly.
I made that happen. I'd begun to suspect that the trunk... But I'm getting ahead of my story.
You were talking about the first person who found the star stuff, prompted Peter.
Right. Well, whoever that was had suddenly become the most powerful person on Earth. And he must have shared it with some others, probably his family, his descendants... Because in time there came to be legends, stories of beings who had incredible powers, who could fly, who could control others. You've heard of those legends, Peter?
I did.
Yes. In fact, I'm sure you studied them, the legends of Zeus, of Apollo.
You mean mythology? The Greek and Roman gods?
But Mr. Gremkin said that was just... That was all true, Peter. Except that they weren't gods. They were people who'd found the star stuff. But to ordinary people, they appeared to be gods. They inspired fear. They were worshipped. They were obeyed, absolutely. In time, they learnt to guard their secret better, to use the power more subtly. Instead of gods, they were called royalty. But they ruled just the same. They grew in power. They prospered. They had families. There came to be more of them. And they all wanted the power. They all needed the star stuff. But, as I said, it only lasts for a while. And then you need more. From time to time, more falls to Earth, but nobody knows when it will fall, or where, or how much there will be. And so there came to be struggles, desperate struggles over the star stuff that was known to exist, and the new batches that fell to Earth. Wars were fought, Peter. In the history you were taught, the wars were caused by disputes over land or trade or religion, and some of them were, but in truth, much of the death and misery visited upon mankind over the centuries was the result of a secret, vicious struggle among a very few people over star stuff.
And were the star catchers part of that struggle? Asked Peter.
No, said Molly. They were a response to it. As the struggle became more violent and widespread, a few of the people who knew the secret of the star stuff began to see how dangerous it was, how there could never be enough of it, and how easily it could be turned to evil purposes. Those few formed a secret society. A secret society within a secret society, really. They swore an oath that they would dedicate their lives to ridding the Earth of the star stuff, except for the small quantities they would need to carry out their mission. Their strategy was simple. They would not try to get the existing supplies of star stuff away from the others. In time, they knew those supplies would be used up. Instead, they would focus their efforts on new batches of falling star stuff. They would get to these first and capture them. And so, they called themselves the Star Catchers. And their strategy worked, Peter. It took time, but it worked. For years, the others didn't realize what was happening, only that it was more and more difficult to replenish their star stuff supplies. By the time they found out about the Star Catchers, they had been greatly weakened, and most of the star stuff was gone. "Where did it go?" asked Peter. "What do the Star Catchers do with it?"
"I don't honestly know," said Molly.
"What do you mean you don't know?" said Peter. "You're one of them, aren't you?"
"Yes," said Molly, "but I'm still only an apprentice. It takes a great deal of training to be a senior star catcher, and one of the last things we learn is how to return the star stuff once we've captured it."
"But what do you mean, return?" said Peter. "Return it where?"
"That's what I'm telling you," said Molly. "I haven't learned that yet.
However the process works, I think it's dangerous because there are forces, I think, and they're not all good. This is probably a crude way of putting it, but just as we have the others and the star catchers here on Earth, there seems to be something similar going on up there." She pointed toward the sky. "And you must be very, very careful when you deal with these forces, or..." She shook her head. "But here on Earth, the star catchers are winning, aren't they?" said Peter. "You have the upper hand."
"Well," said Molly, "in recent times, yes.
We're better organized than the others, but our very nature, we're working for a common cause, while they're every man for himself and quick to stab the other in the back for a bit of star stuff. So we've got quite an organization, and plenty of observers, counting people, and porpoises."
"The porpoises?" said Peter.
"So you were talking to them?"
"Yes," said Molly, blushing. "Sorry about the lie. We've been working with the porpoises for many years. Extremely intelligent they are. More intelligent than many people, if you ask me. Anyway, there's more sea than land. So you'd imagine a fair amount of star stuff lands in the water, and the porpoises have learned, much as we did, that it's best to get rid of it."
"What do you mean?"
"It's very odd what it can do to animals. Some of them hardly seem to be affected by it, but some of them change in the strangest ways. Horses, for example. It's very bad to let a horse near star stuff."
"Why?" said Peter.
"Back to your mythology," said Molly. "Have you ever heard of a centaur?"
"The thing that's half man, half horse," said Peter. "But Mr. Gremkin said that was..."
"It was real, Peter, and not very pleasant either. Something quite similar happens with squid."
"What's a squid?"
"An ugly, slimy, ill-tempered beast that lives in the sea, with lots of long arms," said Molly. "Some time ago, some of them got hold of a large batch of star stuff, and, well, the porpoises were years sorting all that out, not to mention all the problems that human sailors had with what they called sea serpents."
"Oh," said Peter.
"But, as I was saying, with the porpoises helping us, the star catchers have been able to deal with the star stuff situation most of the time over most of the Earth. The problem is that every now and then a new batch falls, and we're not always able to get there before somebody finds it. Often, no harm is done. In fact, the results can be quite nice. Not so many years ago, some star stuff fell in Italy. Our agents got there soon enough and thought they'd retrieved it all, but apparently they'd missed some. And some young men found it. Fortunately, they were not inclined toward evil. Have you ever heard of the artists Da Vinci and Michelangelo?"
"No," said Peter.
"Well," said Molly, "they were quite good. But we've not always been so lucky. I don't suppose you've heard of Attila the Hun?"
"Was he an artist?"
"He most certainly was not. He was a very bad man who found a very big bit of star stuff and did some very bad things."
"Oh?" "Occasionally," Molly continued, "very occasionally, even one of the star catchers succumbs to the lure of the star stuff and has to be dealt with. But for the most part, the star catchers have done their job and done it very well. I don't mean we've eradicated evil from the world, of course. The world will always have evil. But because of the star catchers, it has been a good long time since any widespread evil has been the result of star stuff.
So to answer your question, yes, for the moment, the star catchers have the upper hand, but only for the moment.
What do you mean?
I mean, at the moment, the situation is a bit unbalanced.
Unbalanced?
Yes. About 2 months ago, a very large quantity of star stuff fell to Earth in Scotland. A very large quantity. Father says it's the most that has fallen in his memory and perhaps in centuries. The star catchers knew it was coming. I don't know why, but we feel it when it falls. And as I say, this was an unusually large amount. We had people see it as well as feel it. They were headed to the landing place on horseback immediately. It was a remote spot, no towns around, and our men got there quickly. But the star stuff was gone.
Somebody found it first?
Yes, said Molly. But that has happened before. And usually whoever it is still there when our agents arrive. In fact, usually they're floating at treetop level, happy as birds. And it's easy enough for our agents to retrieve the star stuff from them and help them to forget all about it by... Well, it's a technique I haven't learnt yet. But when it's used, they fall asleep. And when they wake up... They'd forgotten all about it. No harm done. But this time there was nobody there and no star stuff, and that was the odd part. This was a large and powerful supply, Peter. It can be moved, but it takes skill and knowledge to handle it, and a proper container to put it in. So it wasn't moved by some local folk who happened across it. Whoever took it knew what it was and knew how to handle it.
The others?
Yes. Somehow they got there first, and now they have more star stuff than they've had for centuries.
And you, the star catchers, you don't know what they've done with it.
Molly laughed, but not happily.
Oh, I know exactly what they've done with it.
What? You mean the trunk on this ship?
Yes, said Molly, that trunk.
But how? I mean, who?
Bear with me just a little longer, said Molly. We're almost there. The star catchers have always had spies among the others.
After the star stuff went missing in Scotland, we had our spies poke around, and they found out quickly enough what had happened to it. It had been placed in a trunk and taken to a castle in a little town called Fenkirk.
Couldn't these star catchers fetch it from there? Asked Peter, using those, what did you call them, techniques?
Unfortunately, no, said Molly, for two reasons. One is that those techniques are not effective against people who know how to use the star stuff power. The other is that, in addition to the others... The castle was heavily guarded by soldiers.
Soldiers?
Soldiers of the King of England.
The King? Said Peter.
Are you saying the King is one of the others?
No, said Molly. At least we don't think so.
The star catchers have people who know the King. My father is one of them, and they're quite certain he is not in league with the others. But apparently somebody close to the King is, and whoever that person is has made it impossible for our agents to get the trunk. After a week in the castle, it was moved under heavy guard to London, where our spies learned that it was to be loaded onto a ship called the Wasp, and that was a very bad sign indeed.
Why? Said Peter.
Because the Wasp was bound for Rundoon, said Molly, which is ruled by His Royal Highness King Zarboff. She held up three middle fingers of her right hand.
The third.
Oh, my, said Peter. He's one of them, isn't he?
Yes, said Molly. Zarboff is one of the others.
He's perhaps the most evil one there is. The star catchers could not allow him, of all people, to gain possession of the trunk.
That's why you're on this ship, said Peter, to stop it.
No, said Molly. My father put me on this ship precisely because he believed the trunk was not here. It was for my safety. He sailed on the Wasp because our spies said that's where the trunk was.
Obviously, she added bitterly, they were mistaken.
What was your father planning to do on the Wasp? Asked Peter. I mean, how was he going to get the trunk away from the others if there was only one of him on the ship?
It wasn't going to happen on the Wasp, said Molly. It was going to happen when they got to Rundoon.
There would be other star catchers waiting. They had a plan to get the trunk and capture Zarboff, who'd become a problem. It was quite a brilliant plan, really, except that
the trunk isn't on the Wasp.
No, said Molly. They switched it. I suspected it the first day when I saw how that sailor reacted when he touched it. I should have tried to get word to Father then, but stupidly I didn't. Then that night, the night you saw the flying rat, I went down there to check, and as soon as I walked into the hold, I knew it was the trunk. I could feel it, the immense power, like nothing I've ever felt. So I tried to send a message to Father using Arm.
Who?
The porpoise, Arm. But I'm not very good at porpoise, and I thought I'd muddled it, and then Arm came back and told me. He told me...
Molly pressed her face into her hands, sobbing. Peter wanted to do something, pat her shoulder, perhaps, but he was terrified she would take it wrong. So he stood helplessly and watched her sob for a minute or so. Finally, she raised her face, showing him reddened eyes and tear-wetted cheeks.
"Sorry," she said. "It's all right," said Peter, feeling like an idiot.
"Anyway," Molly said, "Arm said, at least I think he said," she fought down a sob, "that Father's ship has been sunk by pirates."
"Molly, no," said Peter.
Molly shook her head. "But Arm also said, I think, that the other dolphins had rescued Father."
"Thank goodness," Peter said.
"Yes," said Molly, "but Arm said something else."
"What?" said Peter.
"He said, 'Bad man hunt Molly ship,'" said Molly.
"Bad man?" said Peter. "What bad man?"
"Peter," she said, "have you ever heard of a pirate called the Black Moustache?"
"Yes," said Peter. He'd heard the crew talk, heard the fear in their voices.
"I think he's after the Neverland."
Peter felt a chill. "After this ship? But this is just an old..."
"Wait, are you saying he knows about the trunk?"
"He must, Peter. He must have been after the Wasp for that reason. He was fooled just as Father was, but now Father's lost at sea somewhere, and the Black Moustache is coming for the trunk. He's coming, Peter."
"Molly," said Peter, "if he gets the trunk..."
"I know," she said. "I know, Peter. We must stop him."
Peter nodded. She was right. They had to stop him. But how?
Chapter 21. The Sighting. Black Stash cupped his hands and screamed through the rain toward the crow's nest.
"Anything?"
"Not yet, Captain,"
returned the lookout from the top of the mainmast.
"Not much chance of seeing her in this swell, Captain,"
shouted the helmsman over the roar of the storm.
"She's out there,"
Stash shouted back. He rubbed the end of his spyglass on a wet piece of his jacket, but still had no luck looking through the thing. One by one, his crewmen were returning to the deck, having changed into British naval uniforms. Stash smiled at the look of it, cutthroat pirates dressed as His Majesty's sailors. Just then he caught sight of a porpoise off to starboard.
"Good luck,"
he thought.
"Strange to see a porpoise in a storm, don't you think?"
Stash shouted to the helmsman.
"Where, Captain?"
the helmsman shouted. Stash pointed. The helmsman gaped.
"Strange, don't begin to capture it," he said. "Porpoise is too smart to get caught in a blow. Never seen nothing like it."
"I've got it, I've got it."
It was Smee, now dressed in a British uniform that barely contained his belly. He'd given up trying to button the pants, and as he held up the British flag, the Union Jack, his pants sank to his knees, drawing laughs from the crew. Smee tried to pull up his pants, but in doing so almost lost the flag to the howling wind.
"Bring it here, you idiot,"
Stash yelled. The distraction had taken his attention off the porpoise. He looked back, but it was gone. He felt a twist in his belly.
"That was my luck,"
then forced the thought from his mind. Smee staggered over and presented the Union Jack to Stash, his pants again dropping in the process.
"Hoist ahoy,"
Stash ordered, handing the flag to a sailor.
"And you, Smee, hoist your britches."
This drew another laugh from the crew, interrupted by a cry from the crow's nest.
"Ship ho!"
Rain stinging his eyes, Stash looked in the direction of the lookout's gesturing arm. He couldn't see it, not yet in the swirling storm, but the direction was right, and he had a feeling about it. The Neverland. It had to be. Chapter 22. Blackness on the Horizon. Peter hadn't closed his eyes all night. For one thing, the weather had steadily worsened. The ever larger waves kept the Neverland in constant, sickening motion, and the groaning and creaking of the ship's ancient timbers, much louder now, made sleep difficult. But Peter couldn't have slept anyway, not when his mind was still trying to absorb what Molly had told him. The thoughts swirled in his head. Falling stars, centaurs, a trunk with the power to change the world. It was an incredible tale.
But it's not a tale. It's all true.
When he returned to his tiny sleeping space, Peter had wanted to tell the other boys, or at least James, but he decided it would be best, for now, not to.
For one thing, he doubted that they'd believe him. For another thing, he didn't want to run the risk that one of the boys would spoil whatever plan he and Molly came up with for the trunk. That was the question. What would they do about the trunk? Peter and Molly had just started to discuss it last night when they'd heard Mrs. Bumbrake clunking noisily down the ladder. Peter had barely managed to dart out of the room and hide on the lower ladder before Mrs. Bumbrake had reached the passageway. Molly's last whispered words to him as she pressed the door shut had been, "We must act soon. Find me in the morning." We must act soon. Yes, certainly, if what Molly had told him was true, and he believed her now, absolutely, they had to do something. But what? What could two children do on a ship full of men? So Peter's night had been sleepless. At the first dim light of morning, he crept out of the boy's cramped hole and made his way to the foredeck. The sky was a dull grey, and the wind was flicking foam off waves far bigger than any Peter had seen. He'd adjusted to the steady swells of the open sea, but these waves were much more menacing. Some of them, as they swept toward the Neverland, looked taller than the masts. Fear tightened Peter's chest, and he felt no better when he turned to the horizon astern. The sky there was black as night, a vast swirling darkness. The deck of the Neverland had never been busier. Slank bellowed orders, and the usually turtle-paced crew now scurried around urgently. Peter started aft and immediately encountered Alf, who was trotting forward, a barrel on his right shoulder. Seeing Peter, he glanced back to see if Slank was watching, then quickly set the barrel down and knelt next to the boy, as if scratching his foot.
"Ahoy, little friend," he said. "Looks like you got out here all right last night. Missy decided not to scream, eh?"
"Yes," said Peter. "She didn't, I mean, she was..." He trailed off, wanting to tell Alf more, tell him about the trunk, maybe enlist his help.
"Not now, little friend," said Alf. "No time to talk. Big storm coming. Slank's turned us around, but there's no chance this tub will outrun it."
He put his big hands on Peter's bony shoulders and looked into the boy's eyes.
"We're in for a bad one, little friend. When it gets here, make sure you're holding on tight to something."
Peter looked at the horizon. The blackness looked distinctly closer now. Alf was on his feet again, hoisting the barrel on his shoulder.
"Remember, little friend," he said, "hold on tight."
And he left. Peter headed aft, unnoticed in the confusion of shouting, bustling crewmen. To his relief, he found Molly immediately. She was standing on the aft deck, looking back at the approaching storm. He called her name, and she turned. Peter's heart fluttered when he saw in her eyes how glad she was to see him.
"Peter," she said, "there's a storm, a bad one. It's..." "I know," he said. "Alf says it's going to get us soon." "I fear he's right," she said, looking back at the horizon.
"What about the trunk?" he said. Molly looked around before answering, though in this wind there was no chance that anyone could overhear them.
"I don't think there's anything we can do now," she said, "but as soon as the storm is over, we need to move it."
"Move it where?" said Peter.
"I'm not sure," Molly said, "but we have to hide it somewhere else on the ship so that when Black Stash catches us, if he catches us, it won't be easily found. Perhaps we can trick him into thinking it's been thrown overboard or was never on the Neverland in the first place."
"Why don't we just throw it overboard ourselves?" said Peter. "He'd never get it then."
"No, he wouldn't," said Molly, "but we'd have no control over who would find it. It would be terrible, Peter. You've no idea how terrible if it were to fall into the wrong hands. Or tentacles."
She glanced into the dark water and shuddered.
"If we absolutely must throw it overboard, if there is no other way to keep it from Black Stash, then we shall. But for now, we must try to guard it, keep it safe, and hope that we can gain enough time until my father can get to us."
"You're sure your father's coming?" Peter asked, and instantly regretted it, seeing the worry in Molly's eyes.
"Father will come," she said. "He has to."
"Right," said Peter. "So we move the trunk, but first..." He gestured at the approaching storm.
"Right," said Molly. "First, we get through this."
"If we get through this," thought Peter.
"Molly Astor, what are you doing out there?"
Peter and Molly turned to see the formidable form of Mrs. Bumbrake, one hand on a rail, the other gripping an umbrella.
"Mrs. Bumbrake," Molly said, "I was just..."
"And what is he doing back here?"
shouted Mrs. Bumbrake, attempting to point at Peter with her umbrella hand, only to see a fierce wind gust grab the umbrella and send it flying forward, darting this way and that like a giant disturbed bat, before narrowly missing a ducking sailor and hurtling overboard.
"My umbrella!"
shrieked Mrs. Bunbury.
What are you two laughing at?
Nothing, Mrs. Bunbury, said Molly, forcing her face to frown. Nothing, ma'am, said Peter, hand over mouth.
Don't you mock me, you little urchin, said Mrs. Bunbury. You're not supposed to be back here, and I intend to tell Mr. Slank. And as for you, young lady, I have told you 100 times that...
But Mrs. Bunbury did not get her chance to tell Molly for 101st time. She was interrupted by a shout from the Neverland's lookout, echoed by a chorus of shouts from the men on deck. A crowd of sailors joined Molly, Peter, and Mrs. Bunbury at the stern. They were looking and pointing at the cause of the lookout's shout, an approaching ship between the Neverland and the storm. The sailors babbled excitedly, speculating on its identity, then fell silent when Slank appeared on the aft deck, holding a spyglass. Peter ducked behind a sailor, but Slank's attention was focused on the following ship. The men grew silent as Slank raised the glass to his eye and focused it. He grunted, lowered the glass, shook his head, blinked, then looked through the glass again. Finally he spoke.
I'll be hanged, he said. It's the Wasp.
Chapter 23. Any minute now. Smee pulled hand over hand, hoisting the Union Jack high on the Jolly Roger's mainmast, as Black Stash watched approvingly. Stash's men were all now wearing British uniforms. Stash glanced down at his own uniform, a captain's uniform, and felt particularly handsome. Stash peered through the glass of the Neverland. His swift ship had turned downwind and was now closing quickly on the old cargo hulk.
Any minute now.
Ready, men?
He called out, and he was answered with a roar as his men thrust their swords into the air.
Keep those blades hidden, shouted Stash. Wait for my command.
He raised his glass again. The Neverland was very close now. He could see the storm was treating her badly. Stash grinned.
They don't stand a chance.
Chapter 24. Overboard. The good news spread quickly on the Neverland.
It's the Wasp! The Wasp is coming!
More sailors gathered at the stern, watching Slank as he raised the glass to his eye again.
She's changed course, he said. She'll be coming alongside to port. It's Captain Scott. He must have turned to run from the storm. Now he's come to stand by us.
The crew was delighted. Instead of facing a monster storm alone at sea in a decrepit barge, they now would be escorted by the finest ship in His Majesty's Navy.
All right, you bilge rats, shouted Slank. We hold steady until the Wasp is alongside, and then we...
No!
Slank looked down, startled, into the frightened but determined face of Molly Astor.
What did you say?
He said.
You can't let that ship get close to us, she said. That ship is under the command of Black Stash.
The sound of the dreaded name drew a nervous murmur from the crew, quickly silenced by a laugh from Slank.
Black Stash, he said. Young lady, with all due respect, Black Stash commands a ship called the Sea Devil. That there, he pointed at the approaching ship, is the Wasp. I know her well. We was in port with her, and that's her.
Yes, yes, said Molly, but Black Stash...
Molly Astor!
Mrs. Bunbury elbowed her way past the sailors and took Molly by the arm.
You stop this silliness this instant.
Let go,
said Molly, yanking her arm free.
Well, I never, said Mrs. Bunbury. Young lady, when your father...
Oh, be quiet,
said Molly, startling Mrs. Bunbury so much that she actually became for a moment quiet. Turning to Slank, Molly took a deep breath to calm herself and said,
Sir, you must believe me, that is the Wasp, yes, but it was captured by Black Stash, and he's coming for this ship now.
And how do you know that? Asked Slank. Did a seagull tell you?
This brought chuckles from the crew.
Something like that, thought Peter.
Please, said Molly, desperation in her voice, I can't explain how I know, but I know that ship is commanded by Black Stash.
Slank's smile wavered for an instant, then returned.
Young lady, he said, even if that was Black Stash, which it ain't, it's only the finest ships he's after. He wouldn't waste his time on an old bucket like this, especially not with that storm closing on him.
Molly Astor,
said Mrs. Bunbury, having recovered the ability to speak, now tugging at Molly's arm again.
You leave off this silliness and come with me, this...
please, Molly begged Slank, her eyes welling with tears of frustration. You must not allow that ship to reach us.
Slank turned and raised the spyglass to his eye again, taking a moment to find the following ship. He took the glass away and looked back at Molly, smiling again.
Young lady, he said, that ship is manned by sailors of the British Navy.
He held the glass out toward her.
Look for yourself.
Molly took the glass, peered through it, then handed the glass back.
It's a trick, she said. It has to be. Please, listen to me. You can't...
That's quite enough, young lady,
bellowed Mrs. Bunbrake, moving in.
All right, then,
said Slank, visibly relieved, as he turned to the sailors who'd been watching the little drama.
We got a storm coming, he shouted. Back to work, you bilge rats.
And you're coming with me, young lady,
said Mrs. Bunbrake, towing Molly toward the ladderway. As Molly was pulled away, she caught Peter's eye and pointed downward. Her meaning was clear.
Meet me below.
Peter nodded. Dodging among the bustling crewmen, he found a relatively quiet place along the starboard rail where he could wait for a chance to go below. From time to time, he glanced back at the following ship, growing steadily larger, as was the roiling mass of clouds behind it. He didn't know which he was more nervous about, Black Stash or the storm.
I guess we're going to get both, he thought.
In a few minutes, he saw his opportunity and ducked unobserved down the aft ladderway. He rapped softly on Molly's door, and she opened it immediately. Peter was momentarily startled to see Mrs. Bunbrake on her bed, snoring. Then he understood.
Molly had put her to sleep.
Hurry,
Molly said, brushing past Peter and heading for the lower ladderway. He followed, and they descended to the hold level, where they had their first piece of good luck. There was no guard. Evidently, Slank had decided that, for the moment, preparing for the storm was more important than protecting the trunk. Their second stroke of luck came when Molly pulled on the padlock. It came off easily in her hand. Their ruse had not been detected. She opened the hold door and, with Peter behind her, stepped inside. At first, he saw nothing in the darkness, though Molly seemed to know exactly where she was going. He heard her footsteps, then a rustling sound.
"Help me get the canvas off," she said.
Holding his hands in front of him, Peter inched forward until he felt his knees bump into a solid bulk. He reached down, felt the rough canvas covering the trunk.
"There's a rope," said Molly.
Peter's eyes were adjusting to the darkness. He saw the rope and helped Molly work the canvas free. It dropped to the floor, exposing the trunk, and...
Moaning, Peter staggered back, momentarily blinded by a brilliant golden light filling the hold.
He closed his eyes but could still feel the light, a powerful, wonderful warmth flooding into his body, feeling so good. And there was more. Bells, it sounded like, making some kind of fantastic music.
Peter! Peter!
Molly was shaking Peter's arm. He opened his eyes to find the hold suddenly dim again.
The light, he said. What did...
There are cracks in the trunk, said Molly. It's not made right. I think the cracks are getting bigger. I've put the canvas back on.
Peter's eyes were readjusting. He saw the trunk now. The canvas was over it once again, tucked loosely into the rope. But now the whole bulk, canvas and all, was glowing faintly. Peter stared into the glow, feeling light-headed, euphoric, feeling wonderful. Molly's hand was on his arm again.
Peter, she said, I know this is difficult for you. It's difficult for me, and I'm used to it.
Peter struggled to speak.
What? He said, his own voice sounding distant to him. I mean, what shall we...
Help me lift it, she said. Take that end.
Following Molly's lead, Peter bent and, reaching under the canvas, took an end of the trunk. Immediately he heard the music again and felt the wonderful warmth surging through his hands, his arms, into his body. He fought to keep his mind on what Molly was saying.
All right then, she said. Lift it.
They rose, and to Peter's surprise, the trunk rose with them as if it weighed nothing. Fascinated, Peter let go of his end of the trunk. It hung in the air for a moment, then slowly, slower than a falling feather, began to descend. He caught it again and raised it with just the barest effort. He heard the music again, the bells and the warmth spread through his body. He felt peaceful, relaxed, yet at the same time completely very aware of his surroundings, of Molly, of everything.
This way,
said Molly, holding her end of the trunk as she backed through the hall door, Peter following.
They easily maneuvered the trunk to the ladderway, and Molly began to climb the steps, guiding her end of the trunk with one hand, Peter, on the bottom, pushing the almost weightless bulk upward with his fingertips. They paused at the top of the ladderway, Peter again becoming aware of the creaking and rocking of the ship. He'd almost forgotten the storm raging outside.
"Where are we taking it?" he asked.
She pointed up.
"To the main deck," she said.
"But they'll see it," said Peter.
"By the time they do," she said, "it will be in the sea."
"Overboard?" said Peter. "But I thought we were going to hide it."
"There's no time," said Molly. "Black Stash will be here in minutes."
"But what if it's not him?" said Peter. "How do we know it's him?"
"Because Arm told me," said Molly, "and because there is no other reason why that ship would be coming for us now in this storm. It's not a rescue, Peter. It's an attack, and this trunk is what he wants."
"But," said Peter, "but..." He tried to think of an argument, but the only one that came to mind was,
"But I want to keep touching the trunk."
Molly studied his face for a moment.
"I know," she said softly. "I know. I feel it too, more than you. But we must do this, Peter, now."
She started forward again, and Peter, sighing, followed. They guided the trunk to the upper ladderway, and again, with Molly leading, they ascended the steps. The wind was shrieking outside now. Through the opening, Peter saw rain flying past, sideways, in dense grey sheets. At the top of the ladderway, Molly stuck her head out and looked around. She ducked back down, her hair now wet and in wild disarray.
"There are some men over there," she said, pointing to the ship's port side. "I think they're shouting to the other ship. It's very close. When we get the trunk onto the deck, we'll go that way."
She gestured to the starboard side.
"And throw it overboard directly, all right?"
Peter nodded.
"Peter," Molly said, "if anybody sees us, if anybody tries to stop us, we must keep going, do you understand? We must not fail."
"All right," said Peter.
"Let's go then,"
said Molly, and grabbing the end of the trunk, stepped onto the deck. Peter followed, and in a moment found himself drenched with wind-driven rain. As Molly had said, a knot of sailors was at the port rail, shouting. In the swirling gloom beyond them, Peter saw the shape of a large, long black ship, very close now. Peter recognized it as the ship he'd seen the day the Neverland left port, what seemed like years ago. Its crew was lowering sail, apparently preparing to come alongside. On the raised deck at the black ship's stern, Peter saw a stocky helmsman fighting to control the wheel as the two ships drew together. Next to him, partially hidden by a mast, was a tall man wearing an officer's uniform, apparently the captain. Peter noticed, even with the storm and confusion, Peter was noticing everything, that the tall man seemed to be deliberately using the mast to conceal his face. He looked at Molly and saw that she too had spotted the tall man. She caught Peter's eye.
"It's him," she said. "Come on."
Stepping carefully on the wet, pitching deck, they guided the trunk toward the starboard rail. The yelling from the port side was louder now. Some of the shouts turned to cries of alarm as the two ships converged. Molly and Peter reached the starboard side, and Molly raised her end of the trunk over the rail.
"Now,"
she shouted over the wind. Peter braced himself to shove his end and push the trunk into the sea, but as he did, the hulls of the two ships, riding different parts of different waves, slammed together. Peter felt his feet slide out from under him as he fell backward, slamming the back of his head onto the deck. He heard a cry from Molly and saw that she too had fallen, almost landing on him. He was dimly aware of the trunk settling gently onto the deck a few feet to the other side of her. From the port side of the ship, Peter heard shouts and now some screams. Head throbbing, Peter struggled to his knees.
"Molly," he said, "are you all right?"
"Yes, yes, I'm all right," she said, sitting up.
"The trunk, Peter, hurry!"
Struggling to their feet, Molly and Peter staggered on the lurching deck to the trunk. Molly reaching it first, leaning down and...
"Put that down!"
Molly screamed as Slank, grabbing her by her hair, yanked her away from the trunk. Peter lunged forward, grabbing Slank by the arm, and sank his teeth into it, tasting blood. Now it was Slank's turn to scream as he spun away from Peter, releasing Molly, both of them crashing to the rain-slick deck.
"Peter, the trunk!"
Molly shouted. Peter turned, bent, got his arms around the trunk, and felt it come up easily from the deck. He turned toward the rail.
"Just two steps now."
"Get him!"
roared Slank, struggling to his feet, and in that moment Peter felt a massive hand on his shoulder, felt himself yanked back and slammed to the deck, the trunk again slipping from his hands. Through the throbbing haze of his pain, Peter heard more screams now from the starboard side of the ship. Looming above him, he saw the giant form of Little Richard, and now the fury-twisted face of Slank.
"Bite me!"
he shrieked.
"You dare to bite me?"
Peter saw it all slowly, as if in a dream, the face coming closer, the ham-like fists closing violently on his shirt. He felt himself lifted high in the air, and he had a momentary glimpse of the horror on Molly's face as Slank hurled him with all his strength over the side of the Neverland toward the raging sea. Chapter 25. The Capture. Black Sash's plan was going perfectly. The crew of the Neverland had shown no sign of alarm as the disguised pirate ship came alongside. While the pirates were approaching, they'd heard some kind of commotion, shouting, then screams coming from the deck of the Neverland. But whatever it was, it had not caused the old freighter to change course. Now the two ships were side by side. Sails had been lowered, lines tossed to secure the ships together, bumpers positioned to keep the hulls, which had slammed into each other, from colliding again. Stash kept his face hidden behind a mast, though he knew his ruse would not fool the Neverland sailors much longer.
"They're bound to notice that my entire crew is barefoot."
Stash had a single-shot flintlock pistol in his right hand, held to his side out of sight. He liked the idea of a bloodless coup with no swords soiled. The sight of pirates generally put such fear into merchant sailors that they often surrendered immediately. He waited, relying on Smee to be his eyes. From the corner of his mouth, Smee said,
"They's tied up to us now, Captain."
"Like a fly in a spider web."
"How many on deck?"
said Stash.
"A dozen or so crew, a few passengers, including some children."
"Armed?"
"The children."
"No, you idiot. The crew."
"A few knives,"
Smee said.
"A pistol or two."
"Our crew?"
"Ready and itching to go."
The pirates had gathered along the rail, their blades concealed in their uniforms.
"Good," said Stash. "Now, call for the captain."
"Ahoy there, Neverland,"
shouted Smee to the other ship.
"Who's in charge there, is it?"
He knew this didn't have the right ring to it, but there was no taking it back.
"That would be me,"
a deep voice thundered back. The owner of the voice, a big man, stepped to the rail. Smee saw that the man's arm was bleeding.
"Are you the captain, then, mate?"
Smee said, then cringed. He wasn't getting any of this Navy talk right.
"The captain is indisposed," the other man said. "I'm the first mate, Slank."
His eyes were on the half-hidden form of Black Stash.
"Is that Captain Scott?"
"No, I..."
stammered Smee.
"I mean, yes, but... I mean..."
"You idiot,"
hissed Stash. Slank, suddenly suspicious, scanned the hard, unshaven faces of the men lining the rail of the dark ship, then glanced down and noticed the bare feet.
"Cut the lines,"
he bellowed.
"Cut the lines!"
But before the crew could act, Black Stash was out from behind the mast.
"Now!"
he roared, and before the sound had died from his lips, two dozen pirates had drawn their blades and leapt onto the deck of the Neverland, whose crewmen froze in terror. Stash, moving calmly, deliberately, followed his men over to the Neverland deck. He sauntered up to Slank and pointed his pistol directly into his face.
"Mr. Slank, is it?"
he said.
"Black Stash, at your service."
Some Neverland crewmen whimpered at the name. Slank, on the other hand, stared coolly at Black Stash for a moment, then, in a reaction that Stash found odd, turned and looked back over his shoulder toward a young girl who was standing by the far rail, sobbing as a huge man held her arms, as if keeping her from jumping over the side. Slank turned back to Stash, again meeting his eyes. Stash was impressed by how little fear the man showed.
"I might have room for a man like that,"
he thought. But what he said was,
"If you want to keep breathing, Mr. Slank, you'll tell your men to disarm."
Not taking his eyes away from Stash's, Slank shouted to his crew,
"Put them down, men!"
The relieved Neverland sailors, who had no intention of trading steel with the pirates, hastily dropped their weapons to the deck.
"Very good,"
Stash said, stepping closer to Slank, his pistol barrel now almost touching the space between Slank's eyes.
"No, we ain't got much time for this storm, so I'll make this quick. You have something I want. Where is it, Mr. Slank?"
Slank took a moment to answer. Again, Stash was impressed by the man's calm in the face of a loaded pistol.
"We have a few women," Slank said, "and plenty of room. But if you think there's treasure on this old scow, I'm afraid you'll be disappointed."
Stash's finger tightened slightly on the trigger, then he eased off. Was Slank bluffing, or could it be that he didn't know what he had on his ship? Stash thought about it for a moment, then decided that for now Slank was more useful alive than dead.
"Mr. Slank," he said, "if I don't find what I'm looking for, it's you who'll be sorry. Now, step aside."
Stash turned to a knot of pirates nearby, raising his voice over the wind.
"You men, come with me," he shouted. "We're looking for a trunk."
Chapter 26 Into the Sea. Peter could not swim, so he knew, even as he felt Slank lift him, felt his body being hurled over the side of the Neverland, that he was going to die. He was terrified, of course, but at the same time, as he felt himself tumble in space, he was acutely aware of his terror, as if it was somebody else's. He was also acutely aware of the pain in his head, of Molly's anguished screams from the deck, of the sound of the wind, of everything around him. It seemed to be happening so slowly. But it wasn't happening slowly. It was happening very quickly. Peter was aware of that, too. It was only that since he'd touched the trunk, he could think about it so much faster than he usually thought about things. He could even think about how fast he was thinking about things. "But I'm still about to die." Peter saw he was going to land in a trough between two waves. "Should I hold my breath?" He noticed that one of the waves was slightly higher than the other and had some seaweed in its churning foam. "If I hold my breath, it will take me longer to die. Is that good or bad?" He decided to hold his breath and to try to twist his body so he could look up at the ship as he entered the water, in case somebody tried to throw him a rope. "Though I doubt Slank will throw me a rope." He held his breath, and he got his body twisted around just as he reached the water, so he was looking up at the ship as he felt his left leg plunge into the sea. "It's cold." And then his left leg, and then his waist, and then... what? He felt it in his back, a sudden pain, as if he'd landed on something blunt, and... what's happening to me? Peter felt his body rising with a swell of the wave, and then, as the wave receded, he felt himself rise out of the wave, all the way out. Back into the wind. "I'm floating. Like the rat. Like Molly." He twisted around and saw that he was several feet above the water now, drifting across the tops of the waves, the wind pushing him away from the Neverland. He heard an odd sound beneath him, looked down, saw a familiar rounded snout. "The porpoise. It's pushed me up out of the sea." It was chittering at him, but he had no idea what it was saying. Peter was sure it was the large porpoise, the one Molly had been talking to. "Arm, that's what she called him." The porpoise began to swim toward the Neverland, now receding in the distance, then back toward Peter, then toward the ship again, then back, more chittering. "He wants me to follow." Tentatively, Peter waved his arms. The wind was carrying him away, but he found that his arm motion had turned his body so that he was horizontal, with his head pointing towards the ship. He waved his arms some more. Nothing. Then he heard arms squeaking urgently, now from directly under him. Peter looked down and, whoa! His body suddenly swooped forward, against the wind, gaining speed. "I'm going into the sea." Peter raised his head. Instantly, his body swooped upward into a vertical position. He stopped moving forward and found himself again being carried back by the wind. More squeaking from below. Tentatively, Peter leaned his body toward the horizontal again, and again he started moving forward, more slowly this time. "Arm is teaching me to fly." Peter began to experiment, cocking his head at different angles, shifting his body, his shoulders, his arms, his legs. Noticing how the movements affected his direction and speed, caused him to rise and fall. The wind was howling now, the rain pelting his face, but Peter felt himself gliding through the storm almost effortlessly. He was far above the waves now, perhaps 50 yards, perhaps more. He felt increasingly confident, then excited, then almost joyful. And then the thought struck him. The ship? Where's the ship?
Peter squinted into the storm, but saw only darkness and towering waves. He wasn't sure how far he'd flown, wasn't sure what direction. His exhilaration was gone, replaced by the cold squeeze of fear in his gut.
I'm lost out here.
And then he heard it, above the roar of the wind and wave, the high-pitched sounds calling from somewhere in the darkness below. Carefully, Peter angled himself down through the swirling gloom, descending slowly toward the menacing wavetops, following the sounds until finally he saw the ghostly grey snout of Arm.
I'm here!
Peter shouted, relief cracking his voice.
Here!
Arm rose high on his tail, dove forward, then rose again, looked back at Peter, turned and dove again. Understanding that he was to follow, Peter leaned toward Arm's ghostly form as it plunged swiftly through the waves until...
There's the ship!
Two ships, in fact. Peter saw in the gloom ahead that the Neverland was now tied to the black ship, the pirate ship. Peter slowed himself and angled toward the starboard side of the Neverland, the side Slank had thrown him from, away from the pirate ship. As he drew near, he heard shouting and saw that the decks were swarming with unfamiliar men, men wearing uniforms, carrying swords. Peter glided close to the hull, keeping his head just below deck level, trying to decide what to do. It was then that he noticed something disconcerting. He was starting to sink toward the water. It was gradual, and with an effort he was able to pull himself up again, but it was definitely getting more difficult to stay aloft.
I'm going to have to get back onto the ship, he thought, soon.
Then he heard Molly's voice shouting from nearby on the deck, and then he heard the screams. Chapter 27, The Return. Blackstache was furious. He and his men had searched below decks on the Neverland looking for the treasure trunk. They'd had no luck in the main holds. There were a few trunks which they'd smashed open with an axe, but these contained only clothing and household goods. They'd also gone through the cabins, finding a few small pieces of jewelry in one, but nothing else of value. In the captain's cabin they'd found a confused man talking gibberish. There had been one moment of hopeful excitement when they'd found an aft hold that apparently had at some point been padlocked shut. But it was empty. Now they were back on the main deck. Stash, quivering with rage, wished he could make somebody walk the plank. This usually had a soothing effect on him, but plank walking done right took time, and Stash did not have time. From the look of the approaching storm, he only had minutes to get off this wretched bucket and make his run. So, once more, he pressed his pistol to Slank's forehead.
"Mr. Slank," he said, "I have no more patience. Where is the trunk?"
Slank glared back at him, but Stash caught something in his look, a wavering, perhaps. He curled his finger on the trigger, making the motion elaborate so Slank could see it. Stash saw a flicker of fear in Slank's eyes.
"He's about to crack."
"Captain!"
It was Smee, stumbling across the pitching deck, his ill-fitting British uniform trousers falling to his knees.
"Not now, Smee!" shouted Stash. "Can't you see I'm about to blow this man's brains out?"
"Sorry, Captain,"
said Smee, yanking his pants up practically to neck level.
"But you said you was looking..."
"I said not now,"
bellowed Stash, turning his attention back to Slank.
"Now, Mr. Slank, I'm going to count to three, and if you don't tell me where the trunk..."
"Yes,"
said Smee.
"A trunk!"
Stash whirled to Smee.
"You found the trunk?"
"Over there, Captain, by the starboard rail. There was a canvas over it, and the wind tore it off, and we seen it."
Stash glanced at Slank, and saw in the man's eyes that this was indeed what he was after.
"I'll deal with you in a moment, Mr. Slank,"
he said, and strode to the starboard rail. There he saw it, an old trunk, its wood rough and scarred, nothing like the elegant black trunk he'd found on the Wasp, filled with sand.
"Clever," he thought. "Put the treasure in an old box and leave it out on deck where nobody would think to look."
A few feet away from the trunk stood a huge man who was warily watching and being watched by a semicircle of pirates, their swords ready. The giant held a young girl.
"Pretty young thing,"
thought Stash, by her right arm as if restraining her.
"Restraining her from what?" Stash wondered. "And why is she looking at me that way?"
But he had no time for the girl, not now, not with the treasure finally at hand. His men had left it alone, not daring to approach it before he did. Stash stepped forward and looked down at the trunk, savoring the moment.
The greatest treasure ever to go to sea.
And it was about to be his. He leaned forward and touched the trunk lid. As he did, he felt a strange tingle in his hand, then his arm. Strange, but not unpleasant. He grabbed the latch, holding the trunk lid, and...
No!
The shout came from the girl, who had managed somehow to twist herself free from the grasp of the giant. She lunged towards Stash, her green eyes blazing with fury. Before Stash could react, she had knocked him away from the trunk, her hands clawing at his face. As he tripped and fell onto his back, he screamed in rage and pain, his screams mingling with the roars of the giant, who had lunged forward to grab the escaping girl, only to be attacked by the pirates who'd been watching him. Now there were bodies sprawling all over the pitching, rain-slick deck, Stash on his back with the relentless girl still clawing at his face, the giant beaten to the deck but still fighting, his massive thrashing arms and legs knocking down his pirate attackers like bowling pins. More pirates ran toward the commotion, slipping and falling as they came. Sank, temporarily unguarded, also moved toward the starboard rail, and he was among the first to see it, a sight so stunning that for a moment all the fighting stopped, as all eyes turned to watch, and there was no sound except the storm. It was a boy. It was.
But that's impossible.
The boy Slank had thrown overboard. He was coming back aboard the ship. But he wasn't climbing the rail. He was floating. A good 10 feet over the men's heads as he swooped onto the deck.
The boy was flying.
Chapter 28. Molly's turn. Molly recovered first, while the others, pirates and non-pirates alike, were momentarily paralyzed by the astonishing sight of the flying boy. Molly rolled away from Black Stash and got to her feet, pointing to the trunk and shouting,
"Peter, there!"
Peter saw it and swooped, landing hard on the deck next to the trunk. He stumbled, then found his feet and threw his arms around the rough wood.
"Stop him!"
screamed Slank and Stash both, almost with one breath. And a half-dozen pirates lunged toward Peter across the rain-slick deck. But they were just a bit too far away, and Peter was just a bit too quick. He had the trunk on the rail now, and as the closest pirate got to him, he gave it a shove.
"No!"
screamed both Slank and Stash, again sounding almost like one man, as the trunk toppled off the rail, and... And it did not fall. Instead, it hung in the air next to the ship, then, lazily pushed by the wind, began to drift forward and ever so slightly downward.
"After it!"
shouted Stash, scrambling to his feet and lunging to the rail, only to find his way blocked again by Molly.
"Who is this infernal girl?"
Hurling Molly aside, Stash ran along the rail, chasing the trunk, reaching his hand out to grab it, and...
Ooh!
Peter, having made a leap that covered 20 feet of deck, slammed into Stash from behind, slamming him forward onto the rail. His hands slapped the trunk, sending it into a lazy spin, the wind carrying it faster now as it twirled gently forward and down, down toward the waiting waves. With a roar of fury, Stash turned and grabbed for Peter, meaning to wring this little flying pest's neck for starters. But Peter was again too quick, seeing the pirate's hands coming and springing backward, his momentum carrying him over the rail, over the side, off the ship. He twisted in the air, angled his body forward, and... Uh-oh. Peter felt it immediately. He could no longer make himself rise.
"Molly said it wears off."
He was sinking. Not quickly, but there was no question. He was falling, gently, back into the sea. He had time to look back to the deck of the Neverland at Black Stash, screaming in fury, at the pirates still battling to subdue the giant little Richard, at Slank glaring at Peter with what looked like hatred, and at Molly, at the rail, her wet hair matted down, her dress torn, watching Peter intently until she knew he saw her, then mouthing something.
"Fly,"
she was saying.
"Fly." "I can't,"
Peter shouted, moving his arms helplessly.
"I can't, Molly."
As he shouted those words, he felt his feet touch the crest of a wave. It passed, but Peter looked down and saw he would be in the sea soon.
He scanned the waves, hoping desperately to see the familiar round snout, but Arm was not there. Another wave crest, this one hitting his knees, tossing him sideways. The next wave would take him down with it. Peter looked back up at the Neverland, hoping for a last look at Molly, but she wasn't where she had been. Frantically, Peter ran his eyes along the ship. Then he saw her. She was at the bow. She had climbed up on the rail and was balanced precariously as the ship tossed. Behind her, Mrs. Bumbrake was shrieking. Men were running toward Molly, but it was too late. Molly jumped into the sea. Chapter 20